From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. One watchdog says University of North Carolina leaders are looking at campuses across the state through rose-colored glasses. You'll learn what she means. State lawmakers deal with plenty of important topics. They also deal with ice cream. You'll hear the lighthearted debate about naming North Carolina's official frozen treat. U.S. Supreme Court justices are taking another look at North Carolina's congressional election maps. You'll hear some of their questions about gerrymandering. And you'll learn why Medicaid expansion in North Carolina would lead to a new tax on health care providers, a tax the providers themselves don't seem to have a problem with. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina has reduced tax rates in four of the last 6 years while building its savings to the highest level in history. Savings to taxpayers since 2011 is estimated at roughly $15 billion. Now, because of North Carolina's success and our economic growth, other states are now looking to North Carolina as a model. Joe Coletti is senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He studies the numbers intently. He joins us now for a look at some of the keys to sustainable budgets and taxpayer relief. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
An important note that you constantly drum into us here at the John Locke Foundation is that North Carolina's success over the past few years is not just about tax reform, and it's not just about restrained spending. You say those two things together are really the recipe for success.
First part of anything budget related, whether it's a state or your family, is that you have to keep spending below what you have the money coming in. And so for North Carolina, that comes down to we have restrained spending over this time, slower spending growth, which allowed not just the tax reforms, but also some more opportunity to set aside money in the savings reserve account, the rainy day fund for the state. And by doing those things, not only does it help the state government and prevent future tax increases, it also creates margin in the economy for the economic growth that we've seen and for the communities to kind of take care of themselves and for civil society to be able to expand, because the first thought is not, what is government going to do to fix this problem? So that's where sustainable budgeting is that it keeps government restrained and allows the community to succeed and now and in the future.
And families and workers are keeping more of what they earn. So there's that individual impact of the past few years' policy decisions. And also, you mentioned the rainy day fund. Boy, did that come in handy when, unfortunately, we were hit by several big-time hurricanes.
Yeah. So because of the restrained spending, because the legislature had the commitment to low spending over these years, and set aside some of that in savings, there was $2 billion available last year when Hurricane Florence came through, and they were able to use $750 million of that to take care of hurricane relief and recovery efforts that would not have been there otherwise. And that's still, and so now it's a question of how do we rebuild that instead of what do we do now?
Joe, you have been talking to other think tanks and other elected officials around the country who are looking to North Carolina. They mm-hmm. see what the numbers are. They see that so many people want to move here because there's so much opportunity. And they've been saying to you, okay, how did North Carolina do it? So you put together some key areas that you think other states could follow to try to achieve the same type of results. We've talked about a couple of those, that restrained spending and also the tax reform coupled together. But one of the things that you say is that it's necessary to have a conservative revenue forecast. Tell me what role that plays in all this.
Legislators and governors like to spend money that they have there. we all want to, if we have money available, we look for how do we spend that, right? There's the money burning a hole in your pocket.
Right.
And so a conservative revenue forecast, especially when you have a balanced budget requirement that is strict as North Carolina's is, means that the legislature and the governor at the start of the year are working from numbers that are going to hold that spending impulse in check. And for the last few years, North Carolina has been averaging about 2% more revenue than had been forecast. And whereas there are other states in the country, Kansas, Iowa, and a few others, where revenue forecasts exceeded what they actually brought in at the end. And so in the middle of the year, they had to go back and start making adjustments. We have not had to do that in the same way.
You mentioned something interesting, and it's one of your key points to making sure that you can sustain your budget, have taxpayer relief, and be on sound fiscal footing, the strict balanced budget requirement. Right. Tell us about North Carolina and how we differ from other states.
Yeah, so North Carolina's balanced budget requirement most states have something like it on their books. But usually it's about the governor has to propose a balanced budget. The legislature has to pass a balanced budget. But once the budget is enacted in most other states, the restraining factor of, you know, how the governor responds to lower revenues is very constrained. So in Iowa, there's only so much that the governor can do. They have to be across the board cuts, and then you have to dip into rainy days, and then you have to dip into savings. In Kansas, the budget director in the Secretary of Administration are responsible for providing lower spending. Here, it's on the governor, and here it has to come from spending, and there's no restraint on how much can be cut or how the cuts have to be made. The governor just has to, at the end of the year, make sure that revenue has exceeded what we spent.
Now, what we see at the federal level when we get into the whole budget situation is you'll have one side saying, we want to spend X amount and here are our priorities. You've got the other side of the political aisle saying, no, 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 we want to spend this much and our priorities are different. And we've seen these successive actions of threats to close down the federal government. Does that happen in state government or do we have something that prevents that?
That used to happen fairly often in state government, but in 2016, the legislature passed something that says that if on July 1st, the start of our fiscal year, there is no budget bill that has been passed, then the existing budget that's already in place that we've been operating under for the past 12 months just continues on with some small adjustments. But that means that we don't have the threat of a government shutdown anymore. The question is, do we continue at the same level or do we come together, legislature and legislators and governor, and come up with a new level? But there's not a zero and one choice. It is a level or a higher level.
Now, you've talked a lot about spending and trying to restrain that, but that's not the only thing that we do with money when it comes to public money. We also borrow money. And in your 7 keys to sustainable budgets, you talk about debt limits. Yeah. Why is that important?
One of the things that the fastest growing part of the federal budget is debt payments. And for many other states, they've taken on debt and have adjusted how they take on debt in unsustainable ways. And so we have some problems with unacknowledged obligations, unfunded obligations. But the practical debt that we have in North Carolina, the debt only goes to capital. There is no borrowing to continue the operation spending, which is a huge difference from many other states. And the amount of debt that can be taken out is limited to the debt service. The payments for interest and principal are limited to 4% of the general fund. And so when you say you can only borrow to this amount, it puts restrictions on not only the total amount that's borrowed, but what interest rate you borrow at. And so that allows, that means that as interest rates go up, there's less availability to borrow. And that means that when you're not borrowing money, you're not having to spend money to pay off that last year's spending. You're just worried about what we're spending this year.
What is your number one recommendation to those folks to try to keep things in line and make sure that we continue what we've seen in North Carolina?
Yeah, the biggest thing right now is maintaining that commitment that had been demonstrated between 2011 and 2017 that kept spending growth at about 2.6%. In order to keep it sustainable, we have to keep that spending growth low.
Joe Coletti, Senior Fellow for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Doug.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Are leaders of North Carolina's public university system looking at higher education through rose-colored glasses? A recent column from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal suggests the answer might be yes. Martin Center Policy Associate Shannon Watkins wrote the column, and she joins us now to discuss it. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
This all stems from comments made at Margaret Spelling's last meeting as the president of the UNC system, and she was talking about some of the good news polling-wise about what people think about higher education. And you mentioned in the column that there are some survey results that say North Carolinians do have a high regard for higher ed. Isn't that right?
That is correct. I believe the numbers were up in the 60s of North Carolinians who believe that higher education opens doors to job opportunities. And even there were some in the 60s who also believe that more people should start going to college.
Yeah. So, and that in Spelling's words sort of bucked a trend. There are some other places where that you might not have seen that much support as you see in North Carolina.
Right. Her comments went along the lines of, you know, we see confidence declining significantly in other parts of the country, but these statistics in North Carolina sort of defy that trend.
Your column, though, said, yes, this is true, but it doesn't tell the whole story. What else were you hoping that people would know once they read your column?
Well, so confidence in higher education in North Carolina could still be declining. In fact, it's very well possible that it's declining in a similar rate to that of the national level, citing evidence that North Carolinians believe that economic prosperity is a result of higher education. It's not very countercultural, as she might suggest. There are also national trends of Republicans who believe that, you know, yes, higher education does open doors for economic opportunity, but that can still be true with declining confidence at the same time.
We are chatting with Shannon Watkins. She is a policy associate at the Martin Center for Academic Renewal. And I found it interesting in your column that you did basically put out these two competing narratives, one that people see higher education as valuable, but at the same time, at least some groups of North Carolinians don't like the direction it's heading or think it's getting worse. Do we see both of these happening at the same time?
I believe we do, and I believe it can be even, let's say, a given individual could believe both of those propositions at the same time. You can believe that I think that in order to get a good job, I'm going to have to get a college degree. At the same time, you can believe, I think higher education is causing our culture to go in a direction that I don't think is very good.
If you have both of those things in mind, what to you does that suggest about what the UNC system needs to do? Obviously, if you listen to what President Spelling said, you're going to get the message that, oh, we're doing things well and we could kind of continue on our current track.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that based on what you wrote, that perhaps your notion is you ought to look at this other data because it might point you in a different direction.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I will say that the data asking other questions about more cultural issues, social, political issues that occur on campus, that Gallup poll that I mentioned in the article that surveyed North Carolinians, it didn't really look at those issues. So I think it would be interesting if a follow-up poll was conducted to measure, you know, yes, economic prosperity on one hand, but what do they think about on all these other issues?
Do you think that the university system seems to be paying enough attention to those issues, or is this the kind of thing that they have set aside while they've focused on the economic benefits?
No, I think that's correct. I think they've set it aside and measure confidence solely in terms of solely in economic terms.
What kind of problems does that create if they're not paying attention to this cultural piece?
Well, for one, there are issues that students voice about not feeling heard on campus because they have professors who bring in certain views into class and it feels somewhat intimidating to speak or to sometimes even write assignments that you think, well, if I write this, then I don't know if I'll get a good grade or not. And these are important issues that students face.
And this whole issue of climate and campus climate and the ability for people to speak their mind, we've seen that play out in terms of things like speech codes and mm-hmm. other prohibitions on people engaging in the free exchange of ideas. How important is it for the university to get that right and not just make sure that they get people on a path to a good job?
Oh, it's essential. You can't have a true, deep education without having that exposure to a variety, a diversity of thought, because that's what really will challenge students to think critically and deeply and for themselves.
Now, we mentioned this all started because of comments that Margaret Spellings made during her last meeting as president. So she's leaving, but obviously we have people who are in the university system who will remain from her staff. We have now Dr. William Roper as the interim president. Do you have a sense that others within the university system have a better grasp on those two different ideas about higher education, or does this seem like a challenge or a problem that goes throughout the UNC system's administration?
I'm afraid it does go throughout the UNC administration. Now, I don't want to be pessimistic early on because Dr. Roper did just become president. So I am hopeful that he'll take a closer look, a more realistic look at these issues. But I'm afraid time will tell.
Well, and certainly one avenue is Dr. Roper is the interim president. We don't know if he will be the new president or if they'll hire someone else. As that discussion is being had and the decisions are being reached, do you hope university leaders, say the Board of Governors, will be focusing attention on this type of issue?
Absolutely. And we've seen the members of the Board of Governors have brought up these issues in the past, and I definitely believe that there's lots of room for conversation to go forward in the future.
Do you think some members of the board really have this on their radar, that they think that this is a problem they need to address?
In terms of diversity of thought, absolutely, yes.
And from the Martin Center's perspective, what do you hope that they will do as they're discussing this? What are some of the good things they could do moving forward?
Moving forward, they could encourage more of the schools in the UNC system to adopt the Chicago principles. UNC Chapel Hill did that recently. It endorses the values of free speech. It goes a little bit beyond or in a different direction than FIRE does with their green and yellow and red light ratings. where it doesn't just measure how a university is doing, but it strictly endorses it, the value of free speech.
I would guess that whatever step the university takes, you're hoping that they're at least going to keep this issue in front of them and not set it to the side, as it seemed that they did with Margaret Spelling's remarks.
Exactly. That's definitely the hope.
All right. We've been speaking with Shannon Watkins. She is the policy associate with the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers deal with plenty of important issues. They also address bills like the one to declare ice cream the state's official frozen treat. State Representative John Torbett explains.
This effort started out as a group of fourth graders. I was attending a Gaston County Commission meeting, and I got to hear a group of fourth graders approach the commission and ask the commission for a resolution to support a local ice cream vendor named Tony's Ice Cream as a state frozen treat. And they said they would like to use this as their class project and eventually get it to the North Carolina General Assembly. And like the good friends, my commissioners back home, they of course pointed out that I was in the audience and that they could talk to me at that very night. At which case they spoke with us, and we said we'd be happy to try to help them with their education and how their government works by offering this at the state level to be an official frozen treat. However, I did say since it is the state, we would have to take out Tony's. This very simply just says that ice cream would be the state's official frozen treat. Now, I've been asked, what flavors do I prefer? And I will tell you very honestly that I'm just an old school chocolate and vanilla kind of guy. But on those rare weekends, very rare weekends, I will go for butter pecan.
Colleagues like Representative Hugh Blackwell had questions for Torbett.
Would there be any distinction made with respect to soft serve? Is that considered frozen?
It is my understanding that is considered frozen, yes, sir.
What about gelato? Is that considered ice cream?
Is it a cream-based sweetener or is it a water-based sweetener?
I'm not sure. That's why I'm asking you as to what your intent is.
If it is a cream-based, then, of course, it would fit the description in this bill.
And would the same thing apply to sorbets?
Actually, sorbets are a water-based frozen delight, so they would not actually fit the content of this bill.
Okay. If there's any cream in it at all, doesn't matter how much, it would qualify.
As long as it had ice in front of it, that would be correct.
Okay.
Representative Greg Murphy is a physician.
Have you done a fiscal note on this to see what this will do to the health and welfare of the state of the people of North Carolina?
Actually, the fiscal note required would be that the impact of the bill, and there's no notable impact on the bill other than it simply just carries on the standard operating procedure of most North Carolinians currently.
Representative Carla Cunningham also had a health-related question.
You don't know how many calories is in that ice cream. I like the butter pecan, too, and you probably can tell it, but it's a lot of calories in the ice cream, so we may have to look at a physical note for health reasons. Thank you.
The measure would need support from both the House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's congressional election maps are back before the U.S. Supreme Court. This time, the justices will decide whether the Republican-led General Assembly used too much partisanship in drawing the maps. Some justices are clearly skeptical, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Does one person have one vote that counts equally with others? If the impact of her vote is reduced based on her party affiliation?
The answer to that question, Justice Ginsburg, is yes. You still have an equal right to vote as an individual. And what the parties on the other side are really complaining of here is not a purely individual injury. What they're complaining of is that they're grouped in a district with either too many people who agree with them or too few people who agree with them, and therefore their vote is sort of diluted in some way. And I don't think that is, in the first place, an individual legally cognizable interest. So I think they have a standing problem. But even if they get over the standing problem, then I don't think that's a justiciable injury. And I would say more broadly, you know, lots and lots of voters live in a district where, either because of geography or because of state action, they're not going to have their preferred candidate elected. Indeed, I'd go further and say most Americans don't get their preferred candidate elected because they have to choose from the candidates that are before them, and maybe based on the district they live in, it tends to give them a relatively liberal Democrat or a relatively conservative Republican, when really what they'd prefer is somebody down the middle. And none of those things, I think, are things that you're constitutionally entitled to.
That's Paul Clement, the attorney representing North Carolina legislative leaders. He also faced a challenge from Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
That would mean, as occurred here, that almost 50% of one party's vote is going to result in maybe less than one-third of their representation in Congress.
That's exactly right, Justice Sotomayor. And I think you've put your finger on what my friends on the other side perceive to be the problem, which is a lack of proportional representation.
No, because all of the tests that they're proposing and that the district court looked at didn't talk about proportionate representation. It looked at only the opportunity to elect. An opportunity is different. The way this is structured, there is absolutely no opportunity to, not none, but virtually none, I'm exaggerating slightly, but virtually none for maybe a majority party to elect more than or less than a third of the people they voted for.
Justice Stephen Breyer says he wants to stop truly outrageous gerrymandering.
What I'm trying to do is to figure out if there's a way to catch real outliers. Just, you can't go beyond that. I mean, at the moment, I'm assuming. The real outliers. I've tried to figure out something simple, not going to get every judge in the country mixed up, not going to lead to every election contested and throw it all to the judges instead of the people. Okay? Anybody can figure it out. Now, this is what it is. That if a gerrymander, is uncovered. If there's a commission or something, forget it. You're out of court right away, okay? But if there is no commission, one party controls it, then a gerrymander is unconstitutional. If a party that wins a majority of the votes in a state, so they won a majority of the votes, but the other party gets more than two-thirds of the seats, you see? That would be pretty extreme.
You're listening to highlights from the U.S. Supreme Court's recent oral arguments about gerrymandering. They focused on North Carolina's congressional election map. While some justices are inclined to address the issue, others have serious questions. Neil Gorsuch wonders whether the U.S. Supreme Court needs to act.
One of the arguments that we've heard is that the court must act because nobody else can as a practical matter. Is that true? And to what extent have states, through their initiatives, citizen initiatives, or at the ballot box in elections through their legislatures, amended their constitutions or otherwise provided for remedies in this area? And I just happen to know my home state of Colorado this last November had such a referendum on the ballot that passed overwhelmingly, as I recall. So I believe there are others, and I'm just wondering, what's the scope of the problem here?
Justice Samuel Alito wonders how he and his colleagues can determine how much partisanship is too much.
If you make a list of the so-called neutral criteria, compactness, contiguity, protecting incumbents, if that's really neutral, respecting certain natural features of the geography, and you have a computer program that includes all of those and weights them all, and let's assume all that is neutral. And at the end, what you get is a large number of maps that satisfy all those criteria. And I think that's realistic. That's what you will get. Then, and the legislature chooses from among those maps. How do you determine whether that choice is unconstitutional? It's a real puzzle to me. So you've got, let's say you've got 100 maps, or you might even have 25. I think you probably had thousands. So you have all of these maps, and you have to choose among them. The legislature chooses among them. And you've already programmed in all of the so-called neutral criteria. How does the legislature go about choosing among those maps? Would anything other than just random choice be satisfactory?
The newest justice, Brett Kavanaugh, could be the deciding vote. He had a question for Allison Riggs, an attorney challenging the maps.
I took some of your argument in the briefs and the amicus briefs to be that extreme partisan gerrymandering is a real problem for our democracy, and I'm not going to dispute that, and that the court, even though it might be a problem to get involved in all these cases, should, in essence, recognize the emergency situation from your perspective. But what about, to pick up on something Justice Gorsuch said earlier, that there is a fair amount of activity going on in the states on redistricting and attention in Congress and in state Supreme Courts? In other words, have we reached the moment, even though it would be a – have we really reached the moment, even though it would be a big lift for this court to get involved, where the other actors can't do it?
The North Carolinian plaintiffs in front of you can do nothing to solve this problem. And
but I'm thinking about more nationally. You're the amicus briefs are certainly referencing a problem in many states. And the idea, I think, in the briefs is this court and this court alone can step in. And there is a fair amount of activity going on in the states recognizing the same problem that you're recognizing.
Paul Clement, the attorney representing the General Assembly, reminded the justices that the issue of partisan gerrymandering is not new.
A lot of hard constitutional issues come before this court because you're dealing with something that was unknown to the framing generation. But the framing generation understood partisan gerrymandering firsthand. James Madison was the intended target of a partisan gerrymander by Patrick Henry. He complained about it bitterly. So did George Washington. Neither of them contemplated suit. Hamilton actually suggested to John Jay that the Federalists ought to partisanly gerrymander the Electoral College for the 1800 presidential election. John Jay said it wasn't such a good idea. All three authors of the Federalist Papers knew about this and didn't think there was a judicial solution.
You've been listening to highlights from recent oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices are considering whether to throw out North Carolina's congressional election maps. A decision is expected in June. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Author and journalist Bob Woodward has written that former Vice President Joe Biden referred to the Medicaid provider tax as a scam. Now, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper is hoping to use this financing to expand Medicaid in North Carolina to roughly 500,000 able-bodied childless adults. John Locke Foundation healthcare analyst Jordan Roberts has been looking into the Medicaid provider tax and why those very providers who would be taxed have been eager to support this. Jordan joins us now to talk about that. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
When we hear the discussion of Medicaid and the potential expansion of Medicaid in North Carolina, a common refrain is, well, don't worry about it in terms of money because it is essentially free to North Carolina.
Right. No, not really. So the way it's going to work is that the expansion population will be paid for 90% by the federal government, and then the state is on the hook for a 10% share. And to come up with that 10% share, the governor has proposed imposing taxes on premiums for the managed care population and provider assessments, which are basically a hospital tax, to come up with that 10% share.
That hospital tax, is that what is technically known as the Medicaid provider tax?
That's exactly right.
Provider being the provider of the service.
Exactly.
So tell us how that actually works. When you say someone would be taxed, how is that determined?
So the Medicaid program is funded jointly by the states and the federal government. Like I said, the expansion population is paid for in a 90-10 match following 2020. And so the way it works is to the state has to put up funds, and then the federal government reimburses it and matches a percentage of those funds. And so in order to generate new in-state funds, the General Assembly will impose taxes on providers that are participating, and they will increase the amount of state funds that is eligible for a federal matching fund. So in essence, this is free to the state because there's no direct general fund spending, but the federal government is the ones that or is the entity that's going to end up bearing these costs. So we have increased state funds through hospitals, lower state spending, and higher increase in the federal tax in the federal budget.
Normally, if someone is about to be taxed, to have a new tax put on them, whether it's an individual or a company, you would think the first thing they would say is, hey, wait a second, that's an extra cost to me. I don't want to be taxed. Why is this happening? But when you wrote about this for the Daily Signal, along with your John Locke Foundation colleague, Joe Coletti, you said that there was a specific reason why medical providers such as hospitals seem to embrace this idea of them being taxed. Tell us about that.
Well, whether implicitly or explicitly, there's an arrangement that between the state and the hospitals that participate that they're going to receive additional payments in Medicaid. So they'd be not some providers, not all, but they'd be substantially better off. And the state would have a substantial more amount of federal money to spend on either Medicaid or other state services.
So they're essentially going to end up making more than their tax?
They potentially could. And, you know, that's where there's been some federal oversight that have tried to limit this practice to try to hold payers or hold providers harmless they're trying to impose requirements that the providers aren't held harmless by the tax. But oftentimes with these agreements, the enhanced Medicaid payments will generate some extra funding, and you know the federal government is the one bearing that shift of costs.
Now, Governor Cooper wants to try to expand Medicaid by about 500,000 people or so, and he's got a lot of support to that. But there are those, including you at the John Locke Foundation, who say there's a much better way to go about trying to make sure that people have access to quality care. We'll talk about that in a moment. But, Jordan, what is fascinating about this Medicaid provider tax is that you and Joe Coletti wrote that Congress has actually gotten involved over the years to try to end this practice. And again, the former Vice President Joe Biden at one point called it a scam. Tell us about Congress's involvement.
Right. So as we say in the piece, the basic tenet of Medicaid is that it's the costs are shared by the federal and state government. And so the federal government views the states using provider taxes, shifting the cost to the federal government as kind of a way to alleviate them of all costs. And that's not the way Medicaid is funded. So if we're going to allow these providers to pay the tax to the state and allow the federal government to make up these costs, then, you know, that's a problem for the federal government. And the federal government has tried to limit this, just like they limited the state and local income tax deduction, but it's used in a lot of states for the Medicaid program, and it's going to be tough to rein it in. But if it were to be reined in, there would be substantial federal savings or substantial federal budget savings.
Let's talk more about this Medicaid expansion population, as it's called. If Governor Cooper and his allies end up getting their way, about 500,000 more people would be added to the Medicaid rolls in North Carolina. I thought that the Medicaid program, Jordan, was about making sure that very fragile and vulnerable populations had access to health care and health insurance. But as I understand it, in your writings, the governor's proposing adding able-bodied childless adults to the Medicaid rolls. Why?
Well, that's the population that is in this coverage gap. But, you know, the way we see it is that instead of the first thing is we know that health care costs are extremely high and a lot are unaffordable for a lot of people. But the way we see it is that instead of expanding a massive federal program that has substantial cost growth, that we should look to the state to try to increase the supply of healthcare, affordable supply of healthcare, and lower the cost of insurance through some supply side reforms that make it more affordable for everyone to acquire. And, you know, there's other arrangements that people can get high quality healthcare at. And so we want to promote those ideas rather than expand this government program and increases the state budget risk of cost overruns. And if there is an economic downturn, we would have substantially more people on the Medicaid rolls and the state would have a hard time, you know, paying for all of those entitlements.
Jordan, it's hard for me, and I'm sure some of our listeners, to understand why it is that there would be roughly 500,000 people in North Carolina, able-bodied, childless adults, who don't still have access to affordable insurance and therefore access to quality care. Because remember, just a few years ago, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, I thought the reason that it ended up being adopted was and declared constitutional was because it was going to cover people who didn't have insurance.
Yeah, so the way it was set up, there is this coverage gap, but, you know, instead of expanding government funding for, you know, inflated healthcare prices, we should just strive to cover these people in different ways and try to lower the cost of care in the state.
We've been talking with Jordan Roberts. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He and his colleague Joe Coletti at the Locke Foundation wrote a fascinating piece for the Daily Signal about this issue of the Medicaid provider tax. You can read their work on this issue at johnlocke.org, also carolinajournal.com. Jordan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.